Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Attention all personnel. Please clear the launching area.
This is launch control. We have cleared the tower.
Roger, tower clear.
Let her rip, Spider.
Oh, my God, look at that picture over there.
Hey, Houston, we've had a problem here.
SCE to AUX, Captain.
I was strolling on the moon one day.
This is really a rock and roll ride, isn't it?
Contact light.
I was up till midnight doing that. Welcome to Space Boffins with Richard Hollingham and Sue Nelson in partnership with the Naked Scientists. What do we think about the new jingle? I think it needs a bit more work. I'll say that first before we go. It's always dangerous asking for comments.
Especially for me, yes.
Yeah, I did an earlier version, but with more sort of grime beat.
If it's a work in progress, well done.
Yes, that is so patronising.
Well, this time we're recording in the library at the British Interplanetary Society. So if you can hear a slight buzz, that's because it's from an overhead fluorescent light.
1950s light.
Yes, it's very 1950s. But this library, we've recorded a few podcasts here, and it's always rather quaint because it's filled with journals, books, rather lovely sort of looking models of either planets or space planes that look like they were concept designs from the 1960s. So it's a sort of ramshackle, a bit like a sort of space scientist's or boffin's brain, really, sort of filled with space stuff. That's the best thing. And I'm sat beside the space and science journalist and writer, and in fact, a former colleague of mine from the BBC, David Whitehouse. He's the author of Apollo 11, The Inside Story.
Which ties in very nicely because we'll be talking about the new Apollo 11 movie, which is out in the UK later this month. We'll also be chatting about Orion, NASA's supersized Apollo spacecraft, which presidential tweets permitting will soon be taking astronauts back to the moon. David, we've been here before. I remember doing programs on the 30th anniversary, we've done the 40th anniversary, but there's so much interest in the 50th anniversary of Apollo. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's a very special anniversary in the sense that it is a half century, and I think we all know that come the century of Apollo, everybody concerned with it will not be here. So this is probably the last great decadal celebration of the first footprint we can have, because we only have four moonwalkers among us now, and they're getting on. So, you know, it's good that there is this enthusiasm all around the world to bring home to those. You know, only 20% of people alive today were alive when Apollo 11 landed on the moon. So there's 80% of everybody who needs reminding or about this stuff. This was wonderful. I mean, I lived through it, and I've never gotten over it. And
I like the fact that you refer to your father in terms of when you watched it.
Well, yeah, I remember that night. It was a Sunday night, and the BBC had James Burke and Patrick Moore and Sir Bernard Lovell. And ITN decided that they would do more of a light entertainment. So they had their experts, but they also had David Nixon, the magician, and Lenny the Lion. And they had quite a different approach. So I was hopping between these two channels, and they'd landed on the moon, and their initial task was to go to sleep. Now, who designed that? You land on the moon and you have to go to sleep. That wasn't going to work. So they announced that the moonwalk would take place about 3 o'clock in the morning our time. Now, my dad was quite strict, and he said, well, you can see it in the morning. And I said, I'm sorry, Dad, but this is history. And eventually let me stay up, and that, you know, those tiny, low-resolution, black-and-white screens, those ghostly images, that, you know, that's one small step. To witness that as it happened, because nobody knew what Armstrong was going to say. In fact, he says he didn't know what he was going to say until quite late. And so when he leant to the left and put his foot on the moon, off the LEM pad, there was that instant when we thought, "What are you going to say? What are you going to say?" And I remember the adrenaline in me. What is he going to say? And then when he said his famous words, I thought, "I can tell my kids I watched that live," and that's never left me, and that's influenced my personal and professional career ever since.
I have to say, of the three people here, only two-thirds of you were around.
Nothing to boast about.
No.
I'm very sorry, commiseration.
No, because I do feel like, to some extent, I have missed out, because my first memory of space was Skylab. Yeah. So I was actually born in 1969. So I was born in September 1969. So my first memory is Skylab. And that was extraordinary, because you got these people just floating around in this vast space, and that was space to me. But the moon landing has always seemed, even someone who's born in 1969, as something for a previous generation.
Yeah, I tell my kids that our generation, and if I include myself as I don't really include myself as the people who built the moon rockets, but I was around, that subsequent generations have let them down, in the sense that, we, as you said earlier, we haven't gone back to the moon. We've dillied and dallied for 50 years about going back to the moon. We haven't got onto Mars. Do you remember in 1969, Spiro Agnew, vice president, said, we'll be on Mars by 1984. Well, there was no chance of that. And I think that what have the new generations, the internet generations, what have they lived through that is as momentous and changing as Apollo? And I scratch my head, I can't think of it.
Well, I would say, going by our teenage son and his friends, and in fact, I was talking to a woman recently, and she said her teenage daughter and their friends, the thing that made the biggest impression was putting that red sports car in orbit, and that was SpaceX. So actually, I think the things that are making an impression today are of a slightly different...
Not exactly
style.
For all mankind,
no.
Though, is it?
No.
With me, it was John Young taking a corned beef sandwich up into Gemini.
That got into the controls, didn't it?
It did, it did. He got told off for that.
We're going to stick, though, with Apollo 11, not least because it's your book, but because of the big anniversary coming. And before we discuss the movie that's about to be released about this, let's hear an extract from the trailer.
I'd like to know what you feel as far as the responsibilities of representing mankind on this trip.
That's relatively difficult to answer. It's a job that we collectively said that was possible and we could do. And of course, the nation itself is backing us. So we just sincerely hope that we measure up to that.
A glimpse there, or an oral glimpse of the new Apollo 11 movie. Now, the film team worked very closely with NASA, and what's extraordinary is that they found unseen 70mm footage and uncovered more than 11,000 hours of uncatalogued audio recordings. So, although it's an old story, it feels like you've seen something fresh and new. Now, Richard and I have both seen it at a screening on separate occasions. It's fair to say we were blown away by it. But after my screening, I got to speak to Apollo 11's director, Todd Miller, and the archive producer, Stephen Slater. And I began by asking Todd how long the film had been in the making for him.
Well, I think practically speaking, it was about 3 years, a little under 3 years. But, I kind of feel like I've been in NASA training for this my whole life. I grew up in Ohio. I've lived in New York for a long time. But Ohio is the same state as Neil Armstrong, John Glenn, the birthplace of aviation. And, you can't walk down the street and not hear those names and, all those iconic, hear about all those iconic missions like Apollo 11.
What made you decide to tell it in a format that didn't involve a narration, that a voiceover or anything like that, and purely use existing footage?
Well, it goes back. Actually, Steve and I both worked on a short film about the last manned mission to the moon, Apollo 17. And we experimented with that form, just using all archival. It's a throwback technique. It's one I'm a fan of, even before.
I like it too, but it feels not old-fashioned, because your film isn't old-fashioned.
Right.
But it does feel old-school,
right.
I suppose.
Yeah. But, you know, I've been a fan of these large format films, and this was before we even had the large format stuff, but we always knew we wanted to have an IMAX release even when it was 16 and 35 millimeter. But it goes back to the narrative films from the late 50s, early 60s. Not necessarily the big large format films like Ben-Hur and Lawrence of Arabia. Those are fine. But there was all these really great short form films that were made for expos, science centers, etc. that a lot of times used really innovative techniques like split screens, parallel storylines, fractured narrative, etc. And I was always a fan of that. And of course, with some of this iconic imagery, you just want to get out of the way of it. You know, my favorite films are the ones where you don't necessarily see the fingerprints of the filmmaker, and they just let the footage and the material speak for itself.
And then there's the other thing is that a lot of, I often feel with these documentaries that if there's someone missing, or it's hard to do a definitive feeling. Sort of, I'm not saying that this is definitive, but if
it feels definitive,
a lot of astronauts have died and controllers, and it, I mean there have been examples where that kind of film has been done well, but I think it's a very high bar to sort of to do that well.
I think the thing that makes it stand out, other than the way in which it's been directed and the story itself, is obviously the footage in terms of what you've found and used. Stephen, did most of that fall to you in terms of finding all that footage or getting it together?
Well, I actually had an existing kind of collection and expertise in the 16mm archive. So that's a lot of that's the film you see that's shot in Mission Control. And in particular, I'd undertaken this crazy project to synchronize audio to the Mission Control footage. So that was basically, it was all shot completely mute. These guys were just going around filming B-roll, as you would call it. And there was no sound recordist. And so this material was just all lumped together on reels. And I wanted to be able to see the controllers actually speaking and see the moments that things happened. So that was something I began in my own time, as it were, before this project.
Wow, that's a labour of love.
To say the least.
Yeah, it's so actually I and I said to Todd, oh, we've got all this, I have all this, and that could be useful for a film. But it was, so probably initially my task, or our task, was to try and find all the highest resolution versions of this material which we knew existed. And then several months into the project, it was actually in May 2017, we got an email from the head of the National Archives Motion Picture Division saying, we found all this 70mm film, says Apollo 11, on the reels, 165 reels. Do we think this could take your project in a different direction? Are you interested? And
that's like Willy Wonka, Charlie and the Chocolate. You've got the golden ticket.
Well, Todd can probably tell the story of when we, you know, that day.
Well, yeah, it was exciting, but we still didn't know exactly what was on it, because the reels themselves just had, you know, Apollo 11 labeling on them. Very little direction. Thought that they were, fairly pristine quality. But it wasn't really until we got some reels tested at our facility up in New York, at our post-production facility, Final Frame. And, it was just a confluence of circumstance. I mean, they were working on developing some newer technology with a film scanner, when a lot of companies are getting rid of their film scanner. So to take this large volume of not only the large format stuff, but also all the 16 and 35, the lower format, and utilize it or have the ability to scan it and digitize it, and then we could utilize it, was really groundbreaking. There was one prototype scanner built on the planet specifically for this project. But when we first saw those first images, I'm speechless to even describe, what we were seeing. And we thought, it would be a few reels of this, but, every day it was, whoa, whoa, whoa. It just kept going on and on and on.
I must admit, it's hard from a viewer to know which is the old stuff, in that you've seen it so often that you recognize it. It's hard to tell which is the new stuff, because you actually see the old stuff so often everywhere. you are not sure, was this around then, but it was maybe only shown a couple of times and it's new to me? Or is it brand new? Because the scenes of people, just those very long, and you let it breathe to see people's faces so you can examine what they're wearing, which makes you feel as if you're among the crowd because the colour's very vibrant, the fashions are enjoyable to watch as well. But then some of those tracking or panning shots when you are following the astronauts indoors as they're walking along a corridor, or whether it's tracking along a mission control, they for me were sort of standouts because they weren't, I hadn't seen them as often.
Yeah, well, actually, there was a film called Moonwalk 1 was made. NASA hired a quite avant-garde director called Theo Kamecka to document the first moon landing. And we knew that they'd used the 70mm crews to film that. But all we'd seen before was the finished film. So as my understanding, because I worked on a remastering of Moonwalk 1 10 years ago, is what we now know was not the best material, but we thought that they'd been destroyed. And so actually when we first heard about the 70 mil, I thought, oh, okay, it's got to be something to do with Moonwalk 1. So basically, if there's something that you had seen before, it's probably because it was in Moonwalk 1, but even then they cropped it. I mean, you and Todd probably knows the technicalities of this, where they cropped the material down, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, it was the Moonwalk 1 footage was one aspect, but yeah, the release of Moonwalk 1, it was they actually released it on 35mm, you know, and we had some prints of that film, several prints that had the actual, you know, not to get too technical, but the interpositives that were made and some of the contact prints with the matting on it. But that was one facet of it. And I mean, it was just luck that, you know, those reels existed. But then we also had an entirely different set of reels that were made by these NASA working cameramen that worked for Technicolor Lab down there. It's quite extraordinary. And then also a different flavor of large format, all those great slow motion shots of the rocket taking off that people are very familiar with. Over the years, we got the whole lot of those out of, you know, Marshall Space Flight Center and scanned all those. And it's a very specialized version of 70mm. It's called Military Grade 1. Luckily, we had the technology to be able to transfer that when, you know, there's very few scanners on the planet that can handle
it. You must be very pleased with the reception so far, because I loved it. It felt fresh, it felt new, it felt immersive as well.
Yeah, I think just as fans of, you know, space, all of us, the whole team, you know, and I've worked with the same guys for so long, the same people, same companies, you know, so we all I feel like, you know, we all just really stepped up to the plate on this one. Everybody, you know, felt an immense responsibility, just not, you know, to get the film right, but also to affect the historical record. You know, we were working very closely with NASA's chief historian, Bill Berry, and his office, the National Archives, of course, and the curation and the preservation of these materials. And that work will continue for years to come. I think it's incumbent, you know, on all of us that get to, you know, have the pleasure of making films like this it's our duty to properly inform the canon of, you know, Apollo and space film. So, yeah, we started off just to make it about something we wanted to, you know, be proud of 20 years from now. But
they're the best projects, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's a sort of labor of love, but it's also a private passion, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. And any more plans, Stephen, to, you know, do your little, oh, I'll sync this audio with that film, and then who knows what's going to happen in 5-10 years' time?
Well, there's an awful lot.
Just to give me advance notice, yeah.
You could do it for a lot of the Apollo missions, but come July 21st, I'm going on holiday. So maybe for the 60th anniversary, we'll do something.
Yeah. And what I finally must congratulate you on is that it felt to me, although it's not a drama in terms of fictionalized like the Apollo 13 movie, when you watch Apollo 13, even though you know the outcome, you still find yourself invested and worried, oh, is it going to survive? I actually felt this way with Apollo 11. You actually feel nervous at times.
Yeah, you and me both. That's you know, unlike the other films we've done, no offense against them. There are babies too, but you know, once you kind of get out in the festival circuit or it gets in theaters, you know, you might go watch it once, maybe twice. But this one, we go to every single screening. I mean, you'll probably see me in the back of, you know, the cinema if you turn around. I get something new out of it every time. Our whole team, you know, that put the thing together. We all kind of feel the same way. We sit through, you know, all these screenings, and we just can't get enough of it.
Yeah, I actually went to the Sundance Festival. We had the premieres, and I think it was maybe the second screening. Just some of the shots of recovery, which are some of my favourite in the, because again, it's 70mm film. When the astronauts are being winched out of the capsule, I just felt incredibly emotional seeing that. With Matt's, our composer Matt Morton's done this amazing soundtrack, and it just, yeah, it was amazing.
Stephen Slater and Todd Miller. Apollo 11 is out in UK cinemas from June the 28th. I actually think I'll probably go and see it again, but in IMAX.
Yeah, I think it'd be fantastic in IMAX. I mean, it's filmed in 70mm. David, I mean, you were mentioning about the TV, these ghostly pictures of TV. And what's extraordinary about this movie is they're using 70mm film. I was thinking about this, and 70mm film, and it's kind of the apex of film technology. We've not really gone better than that. So this material they got in the film is as good as you're ever going to see Apollo. It looks like it was filmed yesterday. But we're so used to seeing these grainy, ghostly, sometimes upside down, black and white images. And this suddenly brings it much closer.
It's gone from black and white. It's that bit in The Wizard of Oz when it goes from black and white to glorious Technicolor. That's what this feels like. I know you haven't seen it, but I'm assuming it's on your list of things to do.
Oh, certainly. There have been, you know, as we all know, there have been rumours for years and years and years about archive material, because you must have, like me, tried to get stuff out of NASA archives. And it's not the best organised of archives, to be honest.
No.
And they often find things in filing cabinets, in drawers, in boxes that are not catalogued, that somehow somebody told you that this existed. And I think if they've got hold of this, as they said, they've got hold of the 70mm. It amazed me at the time when you could go to the cinema and see in the same summer 2001 A Space Odyssey in high definition on the screen in front of you. And yet when it came to even the pictures of the launch and the training, you had these much degraded, much poorer images of the astronauts.
Oh, not on this film. No,
well, that is brilliant, and I'm really looking forward
but
to seeing
it. But I think we're so used to the stuff that gets recycled and the stuff that we see on TV all the time is TV archives. So it's right. Rubbishy video or maybe 16mm, but not the original 16mm prints. So suddenly you're getting this really good stuff. I mean, I've become inadvertently something of an expert on the audio archive, just because we just get through so many programs on Apollo and space history. And there's a fantastic audio archive out there. But as these guys found, none of it's properly catalogued.
It will be catalogued. It will say things like audio 2513.
Yes.
And that's it.
But that doesn't necessarily tally to the number that's in the PDF document that goes along with it.
It's not in order, and it's not labelled whether it's a press conference or it's mission control audio or it's from the inside the spacecraft audio or anything. So
but I have to say, they have done an amazing job. And actually, one of the people who's credited in this film, who we've interviewed on the podcast, Greg Wiseman at NASA, has been in charge of digitising the audio. And it's just the phenomenal work they've done. But they've kind of done it in their spare time.
You know what I did with the audio is that a short while ago, you know there's this argument, which isn't really an argument, about whether Armstrong said for a man.
Yes, yeah.
And you get people saying that, oh, well, he said it, but too quickly for you to hear. And if you listen to the audio, he did not say it. You can actually, with this better quality audio, you can properly analyse the spectra. And there's an A further in the sentence, and you can see that that's spectra, the audio spectra of that is not present in any shape or form. So he thought he might have said it, he planned to say it, but it was for man, not for a man.
What's your take on that then, on those first words, and then what they said on the moon itself? I mean, it was that all out of Armstrong's mind? Was all things he was thinking about what he was going to say?
Well, I think a lot of people I've spoken to over the years have said they weren't surprised that Armstrong said something poetic, but they perhaps were surprised that Armstrong said something at all, because he was such a taciturn. As you heard from that clip, he was so laid back, so taciturn, so mundane that it was remarkable that he said that. He said he thought about it mostly during the trip out to the moon. But it was fitting. It was remarkable. And Armstrong, in his later years, said that, I think it was Wilbur Wright, has a quote that the only bird that can fly and talk is a parrot. And he said he felt like a parrot because a parrot doesn't talk very well, doesn't fly very well, but it can talk. He said, I fly very well. I mean, landing LEM was the greatest feat in aviation history. But he didn't talk that great. I mean, he had celebrity, he had charisma and mystique, but he wasn't, in most circumstances, the greatest orator. He turned up, he did his bit, he inspired, but he wasn't a poet, or a philosopher.
You say that, but I love this bit, and in fact, I even marked it on page 6, where you quoted, you say people called him the quiet aviator, but in 2000 he summed up his own character as, I am and ever will be a white sox, pocket protector, nerdy engineer, born under the second law of thermodynamics, steeped in steam tables, in love with free body diagrams, transformed by Laplace and propelled by compressible flow. Now, I think that is poetry.
Yes, you're quite right. In his reticent, self-effacing way, he hit on something there. And that was said at an engineering conference. And he brought the house down. And quite rightly, he had his moments. But remember, of course, he was chosen because he was a pilot. And that was the main thing. All this business about what he will say, indeed, how he would approach and deal with life after he came back, none of that was considered. In fact, as you know, they had a big battle to get television cameras on Apollo 11. I mean, nowadays, if it happened, when it happens again, the whole place will be full of webcams and we'll watch everything from every direction live. In those days, they thought the landing is the big thing. If the television camera gets in the way, get rid of the television camera. He was a remarkable chap.
What I like about how you've written about Apollo 11 is you haven't just gone straight in on the landing. You've done the history, but also you've used your journalistic career, because you started off as an astronomer and then you became a journalist, ended up a BBC science correspondent and editor, and you've incorporated your notebooks, which I understand from me writing about Wally Funk, it was the same. I had, you know, notes from 20 years ago. Yeah. And I think most journalists find things very difficult to throw things away. Exactly. And then all of a sudden you don't realise 20 years later how useful these are. And that for you meant quite a lot of important people that you've interviewed.
Yeah, I didn't want to write a book about Apollo, actually, because, you know, it's an anniversary and everybody else is writing about it. And as we know, when somebody else buys a book about Apollo that's not yours, they're not going to buy your own book. But my agent talked me into it, and she said, you know this stuff. You must have something in your loft. And so I had four or five really big boxes in the loft, taped up, marked Apollo. And I'd forgotten what was in them. I mean, tapes, press kits, things written on the back of envelopes. Since I started taking an interest in Apollo from when I was an astronomer, I realised that I'd met every moonwalker. In fact, everybody had gone to the moon, some much better than others. And as you know, when you do an interview with them as a journalist, you usually get the same old stuff that they've told 100 journalists before. And it's the bits in the beginning and the end, and when you stop the interview and when you're talking more casually, that that give you the bits that are different from everybody else. So I had a lot of that stuff which didn't go into an interview,
because that's not necessarily what a broadcaster wants
exactly.
either.
Yeah, we want
not in news anyway.
That's right. We want the sound bites. Yeah. We want but everything else. And so often, if I'd interview an astronaut, or if there was an astronaut or an administrator or a politician in town, we'd go out for lunch or dinner, and I had a whole load of notes I hadn't used, and I thought, I was trying to think of a way to write an Apollo book that wasn't like everybody else. Because, you know, most Apollo books are, they took off on such and such a date. They went into this type of orbit and they pressed the button to go into translunar orbit. They entered the moon. You know, it's descriptive, it's technical, but it didn't have any soul. So what I thought, the only way to get to write it newsy, in a newsy, pacey way, was to write like a film, in the sense that you have lots of people talking. So I had to find the people talking, get their quotes, and make sure they fitted into some sort of narrative from beginning to end. And I think that gives it a more intimacy and a more
personal feel. It does, yeah.
And that's really what I was interested in, because I wasn't interested in writing another Man on the Moon by Chaitkin, which is a wonderful book.
I don't want a technical manual either. Yeah. I am interested, and I think most human beings are, they want a narrative, they want a story, they want to know about the people.
That's right. I mean, for instance, in that book, the Apollo 1 fire, when three astronauts in a plugs-out test lost their lives, there's a sizzling quote from Wally Schirra, who said, they shouldn't have done this. They were idiots. They had go fever. Gus Grissom knew that he had go fever. He had complained about the dangerous capsule he was using, but still he went on because he didn't want to fall out of favour and lose his chance to be the first man on the moon. And they died in a fire that should never have happened. It was quotes like that, and quotes from Armstrong, who said that the Apollo 1 fire gave them more time. We didn't want it. You know, it was quotes like that which, for me, made the book a more interesting write than if it was a chronology of missions. And I think you're right. I think people like to hear words from those who were there, bearing their soul in many cases.
But not the words that we've all heard before.
Yeah, you've got to include the famous bits. But for me, this was enjoyable to find, to put together clips from different people on the same subject at the same time, to see how different people saw it, like Kennedy giving his great speeches, you know, we choose to go to the moon, or I believe this nation, you know, all that great business. And then there was about 10 years ago released some audio from the presidential archives, President Kennedy, where James Webb was in a meeting with him. And you have to listen very carefully, it's not very well recorded. But James Webb hits the table and says, we can do this for $10 billion. Now, he'd been told that they could do it for $3 billion. And he'd been told, ask for $5 billion. He goes into the President of the United States, says, we can do it for 10. And that, you know, that throws some light onto Kennedy, who was a bit reticent at the time. James Webb had the idea of doing loads of things with that $10 billion, but Kennedy wanted to say, look, just Apollo. And there was a row between them when Webb said, well, we can do this, that and the other, all planetary probes. And Kennedy said, no, Apollo, Apollo, Apollo. And it was getting into that. And a few years later, when NASA was in crisis, because they didn't know how to manage this project. How do you? Who tells you how to manage the project? So they brought in a lot of people from the Polaris missile project, which was superbly managed, and they rescued NASA. So it's all these. You could write, as you know, you could write 100 books with different quotes in a different thread through it. You know, I hope I produce one which is readable.
Yeah. We've done quite well, actually, because I think the few books that we feature on our podcast have to be bloody good, basically.
We get sent so many books. Yeah.
They have to be good, and yours has made it.
Thank you.
This is the Space Boffins podcast. We're recording at the British Interplanetary Society, and we're in partnership with the Naked Scientists.
Find us on all your usual social media platforms, and you can also email us info@boffinmedia.co.uk.
I'm just going to get a quick plug in here for a program that I made recently. It's called 10987. It's a documentary for the World Service. You can find it on podcasts, on the BBC website, all the rest of it. It is quite difficult to Google, though, because you basically have to type in BBC and then 10,9,8,7. The commissioner who commissioned it thought he was being really clever. So it sounds great on air, 10987. But
and congratulations for Message from the Moon, by the way, because that was finalist in the New York Festival's Radio Awards.
I know, that's a very good programme as well. In fact, that ties in with a lot of what David was saying about just getting an emotional response from astronauts and trying to get answers that you've not heard a zillion times before.
I remember years and years ago, decades ago, going to a party in Houston, and I got my burger and my salad, and they said, there's nowhere to sit there, go and sit over there next to the pool with your feet in the pool. And I sat down with my feet in the pool eating my burger, and I looked to my right. And there was a guy very coolly eating his salad with his burger, feet dabbling in the pool. And I said, you. And he said, John Young, nice to meet you.
Ah, now, my John Young story. Because I was kind of naive young BBC reporter.
Aren't we all?
Not so young now. I was at Houston in the press office doing interviews. I can't remember what the programme was about. Probably the 30th anniversary of Apollo. And they didn't quite get that I was how a radio programme worked or what sort of things I wanted. So, oh, we've got this guy you might want to speak to, John Young. Because he was still working there. So, yeah. So this must be, you know, kind of 20 odd years ago, still working there. He came in, and I hadn't prepared to be interviewing an Apollo astronaut. I hadn't briefed myself. I wasn't, you know, familiar. Now he's a complete hero to me. And, you know, I was asking the usual questions about what it's like to walk on the moon and all stuff. Yeah. And it just getting nothing back. And then I just thought, oh, I'll ask a question about computers. And that set him off. And he was so into the technical side of it and the technology and that engineering side, what you were talking about with Neil Armstrong. And it was that challenge of trying to get an emotional response. But he's just the coolest guy.
He's the astronaut's astronaut.
Yeah.
You're quite right. You hit on a good point there, because these guys, ever since they've been to the moon, for 50 years, some of them, have been asked the same questions. What's it like to walk on the moon? You know, what's it like to go to the toilet in space? And that's not the questions that they like. Gene Cernan summed it up well at Armstrong's funeral when he said that the people who went to the moon are forever strangers. They've broken the familiar matrix of life and they just can't seem to put it back together again. And they fall into the stock answer, the stock phrase. And they're more interesting, as you say, when you delve a little bit deeper, because it tells us something about humanity, about how these people coped with coming back from the moon, as well as the tremendous triumph of going there.
Well, that's why I remember a few years ago, actually, we had Buzz Aldrin interview on for the podcast, and I was getting the same very, very, you know, you've heard it before, but it was deeply, deeply, overly technical, all about his cyclic orbits to Mars and back. And the bit where I broke through, because he wasn't making eye contact. And as a reporter too, that's when you know you've lost someone and they're just saying what they've memorised or have done before, was his ring kept knocking on the table like this. And I said to him, well, you know, oh, that's, I'd better say for the audience, that's your ring knocking in the background. And his fingers have massive gold rings on both hands, on the fingers on both of his hands. And I said, oh, what's that ring? And all of a sudden he flipped and went from monotone Buzz to interested Buzz, because I was asking him about his rings. And through asking him about his rings, we got more of an insight into what it was like to be an astronaut and the level of fame and his background, because one was from his father. So that immediately told you.
His father was a driving force in his life.
So you saw, well, he's still wearing that. One ring was from MIT, so it gave you an idea of what he placed as important. But then there was another ring that was from Muhammad Ali, had a massive diamond in, and had Muhammad Ali had it engraved with his name and Buzz Aldrin's name. So that gave you an extent of how an engineer at MIT who worshipped his father was suddenly fated by the heavyweight champion of the world and was being given this enormous diamond ring. And that, for me, was the best part of an interview. It was about a minute and a half long, and I will never forget that bit as a result of it.
I remember sitting in a hotel room with Alan Shepard. This was 40 years ago. And he'd come to do some Scottish space festival. And I was talking to him and we weren't getting anywhere. I was getting the usual, you know, me and my race with Gagarin and all this business. And then I asked him a question about his illness. I asked him a question about whether or not when he goes to sleep at night and closes his eyes, is he still on the moon? And right, that's when they realise you're not just after the soundbite. You're not just another one in a long line of news media who want a bit from him. You're actually really interested in this person. And when I think a lot of them, when they see that, they do show the depths that I suppose many of them try to conceal, you know, when they deal with, and that's why your program's great, because you get behind the headlines. You know, you're asking questions like that of Buzz is brilliant.
Oh, thank you. I must say, though, there was one bit that I was really quite pleased to read about because I'd never heard about it. I'm particularly interested in women in space. And you mentioned that there was this NASA artist, Cecilia Bibby, the only woman who'd gone up Pad 14 at Cape Canaveral for Project Mercury. That was just a beautiful little snippet there of information.
Yes, she was painting the picture of the girl, wasn't she, on the on one of the Mercury...
On Friendship 7.
Friendship 7, exactly. And, of course, NASA didn't like this. They thought this was terrible. But you have to say, one thing that impresses me with the astronauts is that they know their mind, they stick together, NASA's history is full of astronauts not backing down when the management says, you must do this. And they point out that they're the ones. I mean, John Glenn was putting his life on the line. He nearly died.
I was quite shocked reading that. I hadn't quite realised how fraught that mission was.
There was a time when they did not know if he would make it back alive. And he said, I'm putting my life on the line. If I want a picture of a scantily clad woman on the outside of my capsule, remember this was the 60s, then I'm going to get it. And if you don't let the artist come up, I'm going to escort her up there and watch her as she paints. Good lad.
Well, according to NASA, Americans will be back on the moon by 2024, which seems ambitious, to say the least. The spacecraft that will take astronauts there, is Orion. And just like Apollo, when it returns from the moon at 25,000 miles an hour, it'll splash down in the ocean.
We have splashdown. Splashdown confirmed at 10:29 a.m. Central Time. Orion is back on Earth. America has driven a golden spike as it crosses a bridge into the future.
Since that uncrewed test flight in 2014, the agency's been working out the best way to recover the astronauts and spacecraft. When I visited the Kennedy Space Center recently, I saw the capsule they'd been using for the tests and spoke to Melissa Jones, the NASA Landing and Recovery Director.
So right now we are in a high bay at the LETF, which is a facility at Kennedy Space Center, and we're looking at the crew module training article, which we are currently modifying so that when we start to get ready for crewed missions after EM-1, that we can train the Department of Defense to recover our astronauts.
This is almost like a giant garage, I think. It's just a very high white room. And at the centre, almost right in the centre, is this space capsule. Now, this is it's a mock-up, but actually part of it is flown in space.
Yes, it's a mock-up that we've used for testing. You know, when NASA does any kind of missions, we always do incremental testing, right? So this capsule has done drop tests. It's done modal testing, vibration and acoustical testing. But the heat shield, which you're referring to, actually flew on EFT-1, which was the exploration flight test 1 that we launched and landed in December of 2014.
And now you're going to be using this to train crew once they come back to Earth. So they've been in this, it's bigger than Apollo, but it's still quite a cramped spacecraft for 2-3 weeks.
Yes, sir.
They come back to Earth, they splash down in the ocean, and you've got to get them out.
So first of all, when the crew comes back, because they've been in a microgravity environment, we assume that they're deconditioned, and that means different things for different people. But what that means for us on the ground is that we are not relying on the crew members to do anything to get themselves out. Okay, some of them will be fine to get themselves out. So we use the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, and the U.S. Air Force to go into the capsule and pull the astronauts out. And in order for them to do that, they have to be able to train on something that is close enough to the real crew module to know what do they have to disconnect, how do they get the astronauts out. And ultimately, that's what the crew module training article is for.
And you mentioned deconditioned. It's a very, very spacey NASA word. coming down through re-entry at, you know, phenomenal speeds and much faster than has been done for a long time, they're going to be pretty shaken up and potentially seasick as well once they splash down.
Yeah, so I've never had that experience myself, so I cannot speak to it, but I cannot imagine experiencing speeds like that and then a quick stop when you hit the water and then bobbing around inside of an enclosed capsule that has no air flow or anything like that. So we are trying to get to them as quick as we can and get the door open so that they can see the horizon and so they can be reoriented to being back on Earth.
And this, although it's a model, you're going to fit it out inside, so it will feel to those experiencing this and training in this that it's like a real capsule.
Yeah, so our requirements are to make sure that the form, what they touch inside and the fit, so the representative space that's available and the function, like if there's a switch that they have to power down the vehicle with or a seatbelt that they have to disengage, they should be just like they would have in the crew module. Otherwise, we want to train like we fly, and a part of doing that is making sure that this capsule, this test article, has the high enough fidelity that that's a positive thing and not negative training.
So you're going to take this out, put it in the ocean with, what, four people inside, four astronauts inside, mm-hmm. and then try and get them out?
Yes, sir. So if we have, it depends on what the mission is, but if we have four astronauts, we'll have four seats, and we will train just like we would recover them. We'll put them in prototype suits, and we'll connect them to mock-up connections, right? We won't have, like, coolant flowing through their system to keep them cool, but we'll have the right QD connection and the right length of the umbilical. And we'll have guys that crawl in and disengage their suit, pull them out of their seats, and actually egress them out of the capsule and put them in a small boat or in a helicopter and take them to the ship.
So what is the plan now for recovery? Because they're going to want to get out of this, I would have thought, fairly soon after arriving back on Earth.
Yeah, so we're a little bit different. So a lot of people know Apollo. Apollo landed in the water, and they were recovered with a crane onto an aircraft carrier. So we're a little bit different because of how the capsule's designed. It's larger, and it doesn't have the same lifting apparatus on the top. So we use a well-deck ship. It is a Navy amphibious vehicle that has kind of like a giant swimming pool in the back, and a stern gate comes down and floods the swimming pool, and we connect the crew module to lines and we pull it in and we egress the crew. Now, when we were that was our baseline, but for flexibility, we've also developed an open water recovery method that will allow the crew to get out faster if they're not feeling well. We can inflate a stabilization collar, which is like a big raft that's rigid that allows our recovery forces to stand on top of it and pull the crew out. And I believe that will allow us to do it a little bit faster. But we wanted the flexibility. If we land in really high sea states and we're concerned about water getting in the hatch, then we might choose to bring the capsule into the well deck and get the astronauts out there. So we actually have two methods for recovery. Both are considered nominal. Both of them will meet all of our requirements. And the team's been working really hard on testing all the hardware for both of them.
I've spoken to a few Apollo astronauts, and many of them talk about getting seasick just in the Apollo capsule.
Yes. So, like I said, I don't have any experience with that myself, but even when we do testing in the open water with a different article that we have in Houston, there are many of our test subjects that report that they are not feeling well, that they get sick, especially if they can't see the horizon. So one of the things we're putting in this, we're putting windows in this, which the capsule will also have windows, but we're hoping that that's going to help a little bit with that seasickness. But yes, I can't imagine, you know, bobbing inside of a closed space with no sounds, no wind. You can't see the horizon. It's got to be very disorienting.
I mean, it's also going to be quite unpleasant in there, isn't it, after 2 or 3 weeks away with three other people?
I would imagine it probably is hot. I don't know. It probably doesn't smell the best. You'd have to ask a flight crew member about that.
I mean, looking at it now, obviously it's flat and it's stable and it's in this building. I mean, there's no guarantee it's going to land this way up or splash down this way up, is it? I mean, what if it tumbles over or gets knocked by a wave or something like that?
That is true. In fact, if you look at the statistics, about 50% of the time, Apollo would actually, the parachute's pull will pull it over. And so we have something called a crew module uprighting system that will inflate on the top and will upright it. So there's really three orientations of the capsule. Stable one means that it's sitting like it's supposed to in the water. Stable two means it's completely upside down, but that requires a complete failure of the uprighting system. And then stable three is when you have a partial failure of the uprighting system and it's kind of listing sideways a little bit. So we actually will train for all of those cases. So we have to be prepared to respond to them in the event that something like that happens. So we don't expect it to, but you have to plan for it.
How do the astronauts treat this sort of training? Because I imagine that they're pretty good. A lot of them are pilots, or they're all, you know, are trained to fly. They're pretty cool about going into flying and going into space. But how do they react to water?
They seem to do very well with, I think they're more, we are more cautious than they are, right? So we're kind of like, okay, they're ready. They're gung-ho. They are definitely excited. And we're trying to make sure we got all the safety things that we need to have done and that we have the right approvals and that kind of stuff. But they're definitely gung-ho about our testing. They want to be involved for sure.
And what about Orion as a program? I mean, to go beyond low Earth orbit for the first time since, 1972? I mean, it's quite a... To be part of that seems, it's quite a big deal.
Yes, and in fact, so we're in a development program right now, and sometimes it's hard because I think I was expressing earlier that I spend a lot of time in meetings, right? But then when you step back and you look at the fact that we're going on a mission that nobody's ever been on before, we're going 40,000 miles, past the moon, and we're coming in and reentering the atmosphere faster than it's ever happened before at higher speeds, and you're like, wow, I'm really a part of something amazing that's going to be huge for history. So that kind of keeps you going when you're like, oh, another meeting, really? It's very exciting.
That's Melissa Jones, the NASA Landing and Recovery Director. David, I mean, what are your thoughts on Orion as a spacecraft? Because, I mean, it is basically a bigger version
of
Apollo.
Looks like Apollo. Splashes down.
Like Apollo, yeah.
Well, Apollo was a good design. It worked. And Orion's bigger and heavier. And it does need to have that approach because the space shuttle came back in a very different way. So it needs that design. It needs that flat shield to keep the hot gas, the shockwave, off the surface. And it works. And so there's no point in redesigning it because it does work. The question is, it's bigger. Temperatures are a little higher. But the thing of Orion and the whole space launch system is the fact that it's quite old now. It's based on older technology. And it's also been underfunded. So the pace of testing and missions and testing that has been so slow over the past 15 or 20 years. They really should have got this, what they're doing now. They've been doing this 10 years ago. And I think that's where we have an interesting situation with the entrepreneurs who are able to not have heritage, not have a project they have to carry on with, but start from scratch and design something that is more, if you like, evolved to do the job. I mean, Orion is a heavy-duty spacecraft. It will do the job, but it lands at sea. It's expensive, it's difficult, it's awkward. People want to land on the ground these days.
And the SLS isn't ready to take it there.
Exactly. It all goes back to President Bush. Now, there are good American space presidents and there are bad space presidents. I don't know what Trump is as a space president, but at least he's got the conversation going. Obama was a poor space president, but George Bush Jr. was a good one, and he started off this Constellation program, which had it carried on, we would have had people on the moon now. But it was underfunded, and they top sliced it, and that meant that after the first year, it was $1 billion behind schedule, and 6 months. And then if they keep on doing that, the project slows down so much that, as we see, 20 years later, you're testing things in dribs and drabs. So I think Orion and the SLS was a great missed opportunity. It shows that when you've got some sort of impetus, you've got to get on with it. You can't drag it out over 20 years. And that's the lesson for Trump. He wants 2024. You're quite right, optimistic in the extreme. But if he gets something that goes with a bit more pace and oomph and has a heavyweight counterpart to the over-optimism of the Elon Musks and the Bezos of this world, and he will have done a good thing. But you're quite right.
Assuming he still is interested, because there was that bizarre tweet saying, why is NASA going back to the moon? Which appears to be based on something that was on Fox News a bit earlier. So one would hope that his enthusiasm for space, that comment was just a blip.
Well, you'd hope that even if he doesn't stand or get elected, now who knows what on earth's going on with the American electorate, but if he could tag, if that mission could be tagged to his legacy, he might make it safer and more able to go forward. Because that's the problem. As you both know, the problem is that you need a lot of money and it needs to be sustained. So you need something like, as in Kennedy's days, a goal that's difficult to attack, the legacy of a dead president. If Trump finds a way to make this less vulnerable than it has been in the past, you start it, you carry on, you get cut back and it goes nowhere. If he's done that, then he may actually turn out to be a good space president. So good luck, Donald.
Never thought I'd hear that on our podcast. What
would be fantastic is that at least one of the moonwalkers, so we've got Buzz Aldrin, Charlie Duke, Dave Scott, Harrison Smith, at least one of them still alive when another person lands on the moon, and that person will probably be a woman.
Could be. That would be good.
Amen to that. Well, thank you very much indeed, David Whitehouse. His book, Apollo 11, The Inside Story, it's out now. Is that right?
It is, yes. Yeah. Yes. I'm very, very pleased that Amazon called it a bestseller.
Excellent. Yeah, fantastic. Love it as well.
Do catch up with us on social media. We've got a very exciting project coming up that we have yet to finish and we can't tell you about right now. Hopefully it will be finished on time. It's very much like an Apollo deadline.
I think people will be very excited when they hear about it as well. Yes. I know it's like zip, zip, zip.
It is genuinely very exciting.
It's cool.
But it's, it will happen, I'm sure. Next time, more on Apollo at 50. And we've got some really nice previously unbroadcast interviews that we'll be sharing with you.
As opposed to unbroadcastable.
Yes, and we've got plenty of those as well. We won't be sharing those. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening.